StartupRad.io, your podcast and YouTube blog covering the German startup scene with news, interviews, and live events.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Joe from StartupRad.io, your startup podcast and YouTube blog from Germany, as well as the world's first internet radio station dedicated to startups and tech companies. This time I do have Dennis here with me, who is a little bit not the usual startups that I interview for multiple reasons. But first, I would like to welcome you. Hey, Dennis, how you doing?
Hey, Joe. Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. I was playing a little bit. You're not the usual startup because you guys are dealing in good sleep. You are, let's say, a competitor of Casper with Emma Sleep. You are building mattresses.
We are selling mattresses as one part, but we see ourselves as helping people improving their sleep and with that improving their lives, because sleep is super important. Yeah, that's what we do.
It totally is, and we should all get more sleep. Little disclaimer here, I may be a little bit biased because I'm sleeping on an Emma mattress.
Good decision.
That said, today's interview is brought to you by Hessen Trade and Invest with the brand Invest in Hessen. You can go down here in the show notes and check out the brand. We will talk a little bit more about Hessen and the location of Frankfurt later on in the interview. But first, let's talk a little bit about what you did, Dennis, because I've been looking at your LinkedIn profile, and as always, there will be a link to your LinkedIn profile down here in the show notes in our blog. And I've seen you studied in NYU here in a local business school, as well as did a PhD in finance. Okay, let me get that straight. You went to New York, you studied here, you did a PhD in finance, then you went to McKinsey, and then you started a mattress company. Take us along this journey. This has to be fascinating.
It's a natural journey, isn't it?
Let me guess. You didn't get enough sleep at McKinsey, so you had to make up for it.
could have been the one reason. No, actually, the story is a little bit different. But yeah, maybe the relationship to what I do now to my work back then at the consultancy at McKinsey. That we had long working hours. No, but the story is as follows. Indeed, I ventured into consulting after university, and I was focusing on banks and financial institutions mainly. Mm-hmm. So something completely different. But what happened eventually was that a close friend of mine, already back then close friend of mine, Manu, approached me and said, Dennis, yeah, I've got a business idea that is selling mattresses online and improving people's sleep and making the whole process much more convenient. And Dennis, I mean, you're a consultant. Could you help me with that, right? I mean, consultants are good in Excel files and PowerPoint presentations and the like. So I said, yeah, for sure, I can help. But eventually it led to the fact that we started this whole journey together in 2013. So it's a little bit Manu's idea, I must say. And why is that? Maybe that's interesting. He had been in the area of medical mattresses before. So he knew medical mattresses and sold those to elderly homes and hospitals. So we had a bit of a natural connection there, or he had. He just asked me for help initially.
This is a fascinating fact because I actually did not know that there's any other type than a mattress you can sleep on.
I mean, to be fair, even with medical mattresses, you need mattresses for people in hospitals to sleep on. But the tricky bit there is you want to make sure that they not only sleep well, but also if they lie in bed very long time, that you do not develop any wounds, right? So there's even some health implication there. So that's his background, yeah. But overall, it's about sleeping well.
Great. So tell us a little bit about what you're doing. And of course, I do believe you're not just a Casper copycat, aren't you?
Definitely not. No, I'm happy to share a little bit of insights here. So overall, we see ourselves, as I mentioned, as a company that wants to improve people's sleep so that you really wake up to the best of yourself, essentially, because sleep is so important. What does that technically mean? I mean, yes, we're selling mattresses, we're selling beds, we're selling pillows, mainly online, but also through retail partners. So we have actually an omni-channel approach nowadays. That being said, yes, there are competitors around the world, actually. And the whole story is that we even didn't start with Emma initially. We even started initially by selling other brands through an online shop here in Germany. But 2 years into this, that was in 2015, we realized, well, maybe there's more potential to create impact for people by developing our own products and our own brand. And for sure, there was inspiration around us. I mean, we weren't the only ones coming up with that idea. But yeah, so eventually in 2015, we started Emma, and that has grown until today.
That is pretty fascinating. I may add, for everybody who doesn't know that, people who are laying in bed longer, what you've been referring to, basically they're lying on something more like an air mattress, which is moving a tiny bit, so that you don't get skin damage, skin lesions for some time. And that's not that people are lazy, but sometimes they're really sick, unconscious or stuff like this, on breathing automation or stuff, breathing aid or something like this. So that is medical induced, but we're talking about, fortunately today, only about the healthy sleep. By the way, I was wondering, when you talked about how important sleep is, how much sleep do you get every night? Seven hours?
That's a fair question, I guess, to a founder. Well, I'm lucky. I'm in the lucky position that I really get to almost 8 hours almost every day, not every day. What helps me, by the way, small tip to the audience here is, use your alarm clock, not to just wake you up. I mean, that's helpful. But an alarm clock that helped me at least was to set an alarm clock when you want to go to bed. So my alarm clock at 11 tells me that I should go to bed in the next 1 hour, because sometimes I don't know. I mean, you know how it is. I mean, luckily not so often working that long hours anymore, but maybe, I don't know, watching a Netflix series, right? And that can derail sometimes. So I can highly recommend an alarm clock telling you when to go to bed. Yeah. No, but I'm getting my 8 hours, so I'm doing good. To be fair, that wasn't the case in the beginning. I mean, when we started small back then in 2013, it was like a 24-hour, 7-a-day thing. But it was also fun, right? I mean, that's the intense phase of a startup. Although, to be fair, I mean, I think startup is always intense. It never changes.
When we had Alex von Frankenberg, the CEO of Hightech Gründerfonds, in our interview back in December last year, he talked about how capital efficient you guys were. So basically, you have not raised a lot of money, right?
No, we only raised just above 5 million euros. And I mean, just to set this into perspective, maybe that's helpful for the audience. We grew to 405 million euros last year. So with 5 million euro funding, setting this into perspective for a direct to consumer online business, that was quite capital efficient. Yeah.
I see. A few more, things bouncing around in my head here, because you guys have been raising money, venture capital. And how important there was that you could point to successful competitors like Casper in the US, for example, in the interview we did with Otto Nova, with Roman, the founder and CEO. It was very important for him that he could pinpoint here in Germany at VC interviews, look, there's someone in the US who is doing it successfully. Was it also important for you?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, because it comes down to, why did we only raise 5 million? Well, we were very unsuccessful in raising with VCs, to be very clear. I mean, no, but that's the true story. So maybe we should have done this more and pointed to competitors in overseas or wherever. No, but I mean, we struggled. So we had a list of almost 50 people, really, and it's people like family and friends that invested into us. We had some additional ones, like the few institutional investors we had was Hightech Gründerfonds. You just mentioned it. So they were invested. But also the Mittelständische Beteiligungsgesellschaft Hessen, so the state of Hessen, essentially, were invested. Those were the institutional investors, but we struggled to convince venture capital companies. Why was that? Well, by now I know. We have been very, let's say, realistic and rather understating what we're capable of and what we can achieve. So to be very honest, my very first business plan that I presented to business angels back then, and I got a lot of criticism for that, was 10 million euros in revenues after 5 years. And for sure, no VC is going to invest into such a tiny business, right? I mean, to be fair, 5 years forward, I mean, we were already in the triple digits millions, so to speak, or 150 million was 6 years into this. We were often too risk averse in how we communicated. On the upside, we can now say, well, we always kept our promises and actually outperformed our plans continuously. So that's the nice thing afterwards. But yeah, back then it led to the fact that we couldn't convince any VCs.
What would you now change in terms of planning, in terms of forecasting, if you would ever have to start a company again?
That's an interesting question. I mean, retrospectively, I can say I'm super happy that we couldn't convince any VCs because we have been so capital efficient because we couldn't get any money, right? We had to focus on how do we invest very smartly? How do we get to a better marketing efficiency? How can we build better products? How can we build a leaner supply chain? How can we reduce costs within the supply chain? We had to focus on this from kind of day one. And with this, two things. First of all, now we are benefiting from all of this because, I mean, you mentioned even competitors in the US who are struggling because they're still unprofitable. We are profitable. We broke even in 2017 during the year, and then since then, running profitably. So that helps us. And on the other side, I mean, to be very fair, we didn't dilute as much, right? I mean, one thing I tell often founders when they start a business. I mean, in the very beginning, it's very easy to delude yourself tremendously when you get your first capital. So being a bit more restrictive, if you can, not every business model allows this also to be clear, but if you can, do that. Because of that, we still own a large chunk of this business.
That is awesome. But now when you've been talking, I imagined you guys, because back in 2017, you've been already doing some great revenues. You became profitable. And then your as competitor, Casper, entered the market. Admittedly, they wound down operations in 2020 again. So they have not been successful. Can you take us a little bit along the journey, what you felt first? And looking back now, what do you think you did right or they did wrong?
I mean, sometimes hard to talk about the strategy and what they did in what way as a competitor. But obviously, what I can share definitely when we started with Emma, it started to grow tremendously in 2016. Actually, in 2016, then Casper, for example, came to Europe, and there were more competitors emerging, like in the UK, in France, etc. So we saw that there's a lot happening in this industry. And for sure, we were concerned, like, will we be the one who can succeed in this competitive environment? We had to a certain extent also wait and see what the competitors will do and how it will work out. But one learning, quite interestingly, the competition was rather good. And why is that? Competition in our segment helped educating the consumer that buying a mattress online is a thing. So we all benefited from this, that, I mean, it's not only us being on TV, but also a lot of our competitors were. It drove the market share, the online market share up, and hence all our sales. So we see actually quite a structural difference between, for example, the UK, that's the market where already every second mattress is sold online, vis-a-vis a market like, I don't know, in Southern Europe, for example, Italy, Spain, where the market share, the online market share is much, much smaller. Because when you're the only one who tries to educate the market that buying a mattress online is a thing and actually it's the better decision because you could have a 100-night trial and really try the thing at home and really see how you sleep on it. Well, if there's like, yeah, if the market is not as educated, you have obviously less potential in that market. So the competition in the end was quite helpful.
Mm-hmm. By the way, talking about competition, you also took over one competitor back in 2016. How did you make the decision to do that? Admittedly, it was bought out of insolvency, so I assume it was just cheap. But how did you learn about it, and how did you make the decision to go for it?
Yeah, that was an interesting situation. So it was not a direct competitor. So we bought Dunlopillo. That is one of the leading brands in Germany for sleep. And they had, as you just said, they had to file for bankruptcy. And we were looking into this and found this interesting because we said, like, there's a huge opportunity, not just because it's one of the leading brands, but also because retail is an untapped potential for us. In most countries, the majority of mattresses is still sold offline. So let's look into this and maybe we can build an omnichannel strategy here. That's why we found it interesting. And then for sure, the other element was it was an insolvency. So we bought just the brand. So we didn't buy any plant, for example. I mean, they owned some plant in the past to produce mattresses. It was just the brand. But yes, also the brand wasn't that cheap for us, at least back in these days. But we were, to a certain extent, let's say, well, lucky, or let's say we were more agile. So without getting into actually the details of this process, but we thought already we were out of the process because some other bidder had actually a higher price that he offered. But eventually we got back into this because they got stuck and we were much more efficient, much more agile. So within just 3 weeks, within 3 weeks after they got back to us, we could close this deal because of the speed of this agility of a startup. So sometimes being a startup and being more pragmatic and sometimes also risk-taking can help you in those cases.
Mm-hmm. I see. And you actually been keeping being risk-averse. At one point, you agreed to be bought out by a larger company, by a corporate group that actually exists of multiple businesses and then basically buy revenue generating businesses and basically let them do what they are doing. How did they approach you? How did they find you? And what was the process?
Sorry, by the way, if I said risk averse, I obviously meant as a startup, you're usually more risk taking. Sorry if I said that wrongly. So no, I wouldn't say that it was a risk averse move to partner with Haniel. That's the family equity company you're referring to. So yeah, indeed, we sold some shares, or actually our investors sold shares. I mentioned like this list of family and friends we had back then. Mm-hmm. They sold their shares to Haniel. And that happened last year, actually just at the beginning of the Corona crisis. So we met with the CEO of Haniel, Thomas, and learned that we have a very similar view on how to build strong businesses and how important also the organization, the team, the people are for success for an organization. So we felt, okay, there's a good connection. There's quite a match in that mindset. So maybe there's something we can do together. And eventually it turned out indeed that they've become a partner now for us, holding half of the shares, which for us is also a win for as a company, because I mean, to be very fair, given the size where we are now at, if we want to sometimes maybe take bolder moves, risk-taking moves, and investing into product development. Or when you mentioned the Dunlopillo acquisition, I mean, it's not that we would have anything on our radar here. But if there would be opportunities, we now have a very strong partner for us that could, alongside, like, help us taking those opportunities.
Mm-hmm. I see. Interesting thing in the German blogosphere, there is a little fight going on about the acquisition price. Some people say this, some people say that. Can you shed some light on this?
I don't think that we have disclosed this, so I can't.
Too bad, but I had to ask. So, but the company is just controlling 50% of your company, and the other 50% are still owned by the founders?
Exactly. So, the 50% is Haniel, and then 25% is Manu, and 25% is what I still hold.
What is the plan with you and the backing of the Haniel Group? Conquer the world, take over Europe. Where are you currently active, and what are the next steps?
I like the first point you said, conquer the world. Now, I mean, our goal is...
it's only because I'm a big fan of Pinky and the Brain. What are we going to do tonight, Pinky? Conquer the world.
Yeah. I love those in my childhood as well. Haven't seen them for a while, though. But I mean, our goal as a company is to become the number one global sleep brand. And we're doing quite well. I mean, we sold 1.5 million mattresses last year, and with that actually being already the biggest sleep brand in Europe. And we have already opened our, we have some offices outside of Europe, but also opened new markets. So we are now active from Mexico to Brazil to Australia to South Korea and Japan. So a lot of countries we're now active in, as the goal is to help people around the world sleep better with our products. So that is the plan. That's a long-term plan. And that's also what's so nice about our partner with Haniel. Haniel also has a long-term view on things and is not, for example, sometimes if you have a very financially oriented investor, sometimes their horizon is more like, let's look at 3 years or something. That's not the case. The good thing is really we can take the decisions as they make sense for us as a business, for our consumers, and progress long-term.
Well, sometimes with very aggressive investors, I've more seen, let's talk about the next 3 months.
I mean, to be fair, in a startup also, you often have rather a 3 month perspective. Sometimes if the banks ask me, okay, what's your 12-month plan? I mean, I do have a 12-month plan, but to be very fair, if you're really agile as a startup, well, you rather look into the next 3 months. That's what it is, because who are you to know what the future will look like in 6 months, 8 months, 10 months down the road? That is already tricky sometimes, right?
Yes. And if Corona has proven something, that most long-term forecasts are just for the trash bin. But do you have something like a 5-year plan?
I mean, we do have a long-term plan where we want to go to, because also it helps. I think that's the benefit. It sets a target, sets the ambition level, and helps with getting the organization aligned on this joint goal. I think that's important. For example, what we do, every Tuesday we have our all hands, where everyone comes together nowadays virtually. And one part of this all hands is always, what is our long-term plan? Where do we want to be in a few years from now? And what are the pillars that will get us there, so that everyone understands what's the strategy, what's the vision? And that brings a lot of alignment. So yes, that exists. But also we are agile enough and flexible enough to accept that sometimes things don't work out and you have to change your plan.
I see. When you mentioned meeting virtually, that's also on my question list. How did Corona impact you guys?
I mean, the Corona impact can be split into different ways, right? I mean, one element is supply chain, for example. I mean, supply chain luckily is very robust. We have a very diversified supply chain, producing often even locally, so that has worked very well. Maybe one mention, I mean, that's something we see across the industries, raw material prices are increasing. I'm not sure whether it's due to Corona or what's exactly happening, but across many industries, I'm hearing that raw material prices are increasing. So that's maybe one of the challenges, but I wouldn't tie it directly to Corona. What is obviously more important, or was a direct impact, is on the sales with lockdowns. As an online business, often online businesses have seen that this rather boosted sales. For sure, when the lockdown was lifted, you sometimes also saw the reverse effect. And then the third element is employees. And there, although we have been a digital company back then already, and we have a lot of digital natives in our company, and we think average age in our company is 28 years old. I mean, we have 730 people, just to give you a little bit of a feel for the size, but the average age is still around 28. We had to adopt then working completely virtually. And definitely what I can say, Microsoft Teams is a great tool for us. So that has helped us tremendously to adopt this virtual meetings and virtual brainstormings and what else you do virtually within actually just a few days. But I mean, that was last year. Now it's more like, okay, how do we adopt now a hybrid working style? How do hybrid meetings work where some people are in the office, some people are in a video conference virtually? Those are now elements we need to look at.
Did you also see changes of behavior on the client side? Did they hold back on purchases during the first wave of Corona, or did they just say, okay, now everybody goes and buys mattresses online?
Interestingly, furniture and home had been a huge topic within the Corona crisis because people spent more time at home. So when you look at statistics, like where would people spend more than the year before, it was often home furniture, etc. So there was a bit of a booster. But also you see, as I said, it can revert back when lockdowns were lifted, the weather got better, etc. So you also saw like the reverse effect partially.
Mm-hmm. When you are physical in the office, I was just wondering, because your sleep company, is there a power nap room?
Indeed, we do have 3 power nap stations. though I must say, we opened or moved to this office in April last year. So just when the lockdowns happened. And so we are just getting back more and more people into the office. I have not seen them being used, actually. So, and as we need more and more space for like those virtual meetings, we're now actually thinking of converting them to normal rooms. That is a bit boring, unfortunately, but yeah, they do exist. So if you want, come over. I mean, we're here in Frankfurt, right? Come over. I can show you those little booths. But yeah, let's see whether we'll have them for long.
You talked about the office. Let's talk a little bit about, because this is sponsored by Invest in Hessen, talk a little bit about the advantages and disadvantages of being located here in Frankfurt for you. But I do believe from a logistics standpoint, meaning shipping out your mattresses, it actually makes sense, right?
Well, maybe it would make sense to ship them from Frankfurt in terms of logistics, but to be very honest, we are not shipping from Frankfurt. We have we have production partners, as I mentioned before. So the supply chain is very international, and we do not produce here in Frankfurt. So that's not the reason we're here. I mean, the reason why we're here initially was because Manu and me were here, but also to say this very clearly, we're super happy that we're here. I mean, many founders believe they need to move to Berlin because that's where all the talent is, where the whole startup scene is, etc. Actually, I think the opposite is true. And when sometimes, and I know that's not the most, how to say, it's not a widespread opinion. I might be alone with that, but I actually tell founders to rather not start in Berlin, but rather, I mean, I'm not necessarily saying it needs to be Frankfurt. I'll tell you though why I'm very happy with Frankfurt, but it could be any other city. Because in Berlin, you often have the issue because there's so many opportunities for talent. You see often that people don't stay that long in a company. And if you want to build a strong team, you need also that they stay for a couple of years. And that's very tricky. So while it might be easier to attract talent in Berlin, they often don't stay as long. So we have people, I know someone just left who started with us 7 years ago. So really have this long, and it was a developer, by the way, maybe to add this. So usually I think developers are people who are very prone to being hunted by other companies. So you can build a strong team. For example, in Frankfurt also, we have tons of great universities in the region. So the talent pool is really strong. For sure, you might not find someone who's done, I don't know, performance marketing for 5-10 years, but that's something you can learn. So we are super happy with this. And I think, yeah, by now also that we've grown a little bit, there are not so many larger startups. So if someone wants to join a larger startup in Frankfurt or in the region, we are one of the few that they can look at. So it is actually an advantage. So when it gets to talent, I think it is super helpful. And hence, yeah, I think it is rather helpful to start it outside of Berlin, maybe even in Frankfurt. And we have great other startups here in Frankfurt, right? I mean, like Clark, Lily Do, etc.
Yeah, Christopher comes to mind. We had him in the interview for the funding round of more than $80 million and many, many others. Yes.
They knew how to do it, right? I should have asked him.
You still can.
And now we're break even, like we're profitable, so not needed at the moment. But yeah, maybe I should once that would change.
My last question was, we are going to play Make-A-Wish. And you okay. could make a wish. What do you want to see changed in the Frankfurt landscape from the political side? Meaning this is listened to also in the Ministry of Economics at Hessen Trade Invest. What do you wish for from those guys to change or to improve?
I think what will help us is connecting the people. I know that there's also initiatives already happening, so that's good to see. But what felt helped us a lot was getting to know people, talking to them, learning how things work, learning who's an expert, for example, in performance marketing, and building this network. I think that is one of the key elements, and I think that's something politics can support.
Well, great closing words. Admittedly, there's nothing I have to add. Only thing left for me to say is thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
It was fun, Joe. Thank you very much, and have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
That's all, folks. Find more news, streams, events, and interviews at www.startuprad.io. Remember, sharing is caring.